Good morning. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the July 24th, 2013 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. And every other fifth Wednesday, when I open the phones to you, our listeners, which will be the case next Wednesday, July 31st. The public's attention to the whereabouts and future of super NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden and his ongoing revelations regarding the extent to which the Obama administration has spied on U.S. citizens and America's allies was diverted these past 2 weeks by another case of injustice with a far longer pedigree, the acquittal of George Zimmerman for the murder of Trayvon Martin and the protest and national dialogue that have followed. We're going to return today, however, to the surveillance story, which does, in fact, have a much longer history of which most Americans have been unaware. At 20 minutes past the hour, approximately, I'll be speaking with Professor Alfred McCoy, author of Policing America's Empire, The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State, and a recent article of Tom Dispatch entitled Surveillance Blowback, The Making of U.S. Surveillance State, 1898 to 2020, which is based on the book and traces its lineage back to the U.S. war on the Philippines. In the meantime, let's take a look at some other things that have been happening since my last program. I want to begin by paying my respects to the memory of Helen Thomas, that remarkable journalist and human being who I interviewed in 2011 and who passed away last week at the age of 92 at her home in Washington, D.C., where for years she reigned as the dean of White House correspondence and the nightmare of every president and the White House spokesperson since Lyndon Johnson. In my email yesterday, as well as on Counterpunch, was a fitting tribute to Helen by my close friend Barbara Lubin of the Middle East Children's Alliance and a colleague of hers, Danny Muller, from Voices in the Wilderness, which expresses much of my sentiments. It began this way. When the news spread through Washington this weekend that the unwavering, pioneering journalist Helen Thomas had died, there must have been a collective sigh of relief throughout the halls of Washington. News articles and obituaries are obligatorily mentioning her retirement over political remarks about Palestine and Israel. They all will and should celebrate her trailblazing career as a journalist and author. And now that she has died, wrote Lubin and Muller, it has become politically correct to re-embrace her because now Helen is safe. She will not be asking the uncomfortable questions anymore, questions that made lying politicians squirm as they stared dumbfounded back at her, always surprised at freedom of the press in action, at a woman who did not know her place. But in Helen's final years, there was little celebration of her career and her courage, as former friends, co-workers, and many in Washington jumped on the bandwagon, resolutely condemning her for comments made in a hit piece that took brief comments out of context. Perhaps most appallingly, wrote Lubin and Muller, President Obama took time from spying on one half of the world and bombing the other half to state that her resignation was, quote unquote, the right decision. In a world where politicians like George Bush, Dick Cheney, and Rahm Emanuel are celebrated for their reputations for expletive-laden tirades, can we really pretend that Helen's comments were so shocking or offensive that they were worthy of forced retirement? In a world where we hear the daily drivel from presidents promoting wars of madness with lies and straight faces, how do we let such vitriol rain down on her? Asked Lubin and Muller. If one followed her career, especially in the last decade, they write, she had upset the status quo repeatedly by asking about the deaths of civilians in America's wars, the unholy alliance with Israel, their unspoken nuclear arsenal, and the way we hide the face of war, end quote. Well, powerful people wanted her silenced and used a 30-second video snippet to try and erase 7 decades of integrity and public service. That was an excerpt from a tribute to Helen Thomas by Barbara Lubin and Danny Muller, which can be read in its entirety on the Counterpunch website. I recommend that you do so. The comment that destroyed her career was her response to a rabbi who had an event on the White House lawn asked Thomas what she thought of the Israel-Palestine conflict. She quickly replied offhand that the Israeli Jews should get out of Palestine and go back where they came from, a sentiment while not realistic, was no doubt shared by many of Israel's critics, and not just those of Arab descent, as was Helen Thomas. American politicians, leading newspaper columnists, TV talking heads, and Jewish leaders have made far more destructive statements about the Palestinians without having to pay any price, let alone apologize. That they can do that is simply another example, as if we needed one, of who holds the power in these United States. Today we have two other glaring examples of Washington's being Israel's most important occupied territory. First, in what was largely a rerun of Chuck Hagel's Senate confirmation hearing for defense secretary, but with bouquets instead of brickbats, Samantha Power was approved by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to be the new U.S. ambassador to the U.N. As with her immediate predecessors, neocon artist John Bolton under George W. Bush and Susan Rice in Obama's first term, Power's first responsibility will not be to represent the interests of the American people, but to defend Israel. As reported in the Washington publication The Hill, Power promised the senators last Wednesday to, quote, stand up for Israel and work tirelessly to defend it, end quote, as she sought to put at rest their concerns about her support for the U.S. ally. Israel's legitimacy should be beyond dispute, and its security must be beyond doubt, she told the Senate committee. The United States has no greater friend in the world than the state of Israel, said Power. We share security interests, we share core values, and we have a special relationship with Israel, end quote. Just as I have done the last 4 years, she said, as President Obama's advisor at the White House, I will stand up for Israel and work tirelessly to defend it, end quote. Power had been criticized for comments she made during an interview in 2002 urging a, quote, a mammoth protection force, end quote, to prevent hypothetical atrocities between Israelis and Palestinians, even if that, quote, might mean alienating a domestic constituency of tremendous political and financial import, end quote. Power since disowned the remarks, holding a special meeting with 40 leaders of that, quote, unquote, domestic constituency, in which she tearfully pledged her allegiance to Israel. Her responses to the senators showed that she's come around to the view that America's role at the UN is to staunchly defend its top Middle East ally and to oppose Palestinian efforts to seek greater international recognition. She criticized the UN General Assembly and the UN Human Rights Council for repeatedly passing resolutions criticizing Israel and delegitimizing the Jewish state. Committee Chief Robert Menendez, the Cuban-born New Jersey Democrat, asked Power directly if she would work to support Israel's bid for a seat in the UN Security Council, which contains 5 permanent members and 10 rotating seats assigned by region. Israel, which has never sat on the Security Council, wants to be admitted as a representative of the Western European group of countries since, despite its location, it has never seen itself as a Middle Eastern country. Absolutely, sir, Power responded, virtually, if not literally, clicking her heels. The Security Council seat is one that has eluded Israel, despite its many contributions across the years, she piped up. And I commit to you wholeheartedly to go on offense as well as playing defense on the legitimation of Israel, and we'll make every effort to secure greater integration of Israeli public servants in the UN system, end quote. There was no mention in any article I read what Power promises is due for the United States. Well, whether the Europeans, Israel's leading trading partners, will allow Power to advise them as to who besides Britain and France should represent them on the Security Council remains to be seen. Last week, the European Union decreed that, quote, all agreements between the State of Israel and the EU must unequivocally and explicitly indicate their inapplicability to the territories occupied by Israel in 1967, including East Jerusalem. According to the EU declaration, contracts between EU member states and Israel must include a clause stating that East Jerusalem and the West Bank are not part of the State of Israel and therefore not part of the contract. The decree, which was to go into effect Friday, will forbid any cooperation, awarding of grants, prizes, and fundings for any Israeli entity in those specified areas. The EU action is going to be expected to anguish allegations of anti-Semitism from an outraged Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu. We will not accept any outside diktat about our borders, Netanyahu pledged, adding, this issue will be decided only in direct negotiations between the sides, end quote. Expressing solidarity with all Israeli citizens, he promised that, quote, as a prime minister of Israel, I will not allow the hundreds of thousands of Israelis who live in Judea and Samaria, that's what they call the West Bank, on the Golan Heights in Jerusalem, our united capital, to be harmed. end quote. His trained SEALs in the American Jewish establishment echoed his criticisms, while an Obama administration spokesperson said the EU action was, quote unquote, unhelpful. German Chancellor Angela Merkel, apparently guilt-tripped by Israeli officials, is already backpedaling from the agreement, and given Israel's history of being able to manipulate its European allies, others may follow. Which brings us to the latest chapter in the Middle East's longest-running soap opera, the so-called peace process with its two-state solution. From its inception more than two decades ago, it has blinded the world to de facto realities of the Israel-Palestine conflict while allowing Israel to build more illegal towns and housing tracts in the conquered territory in violation of international law. The first de facto reality has been that since it attacked Egypt in 1967 and went on to capture the West Bank and Gaza, Israel has been a single apartheid state, controlling every inch of land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. The Oslo Agreement in 1992, despite allusions to the contrary, did nothing to change that. In fact, it made it worse. First, Oslo acknowledged that Israel had a right to place settlers in land beyond the 67 so-called Green Line and could legally administer a significant portion of occupied Palestinian land while maintaining a military control over the entire area. Second, it set up a Palestinian Authority whose main job would be to suppress armed Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation while standing aside whenever Israel decided to exercise its habit of raiding Palestinian villages and refugee camps to kill and arrest people and demolish homes. Thanks to funding by Washington and training by the U.S. and Jordanian military, it has done that to the express satisfaction of the Israelis. Finally, as a result of the success of the first two realities, there's nothing resembling a war in the West Bank or Gaza, which requires a peace process. And there is no pressure on the part of the Israeli public to negotiate with the Palestinians for an end to the occupation. The evidence for the lack of any war can be found in numerous videos that depict Israeli soldiers casually walking through Palestinian villages, humiliating and arresting people, even small children, while not bothering to wear their helmets. Since the end of the Second Intifada a decade ago, the Palestinians in the West Bank, their nonviolent protests notwithstanding, have been largely pacified. On March 3, 2002, however, during that Intifada, a Palestinian sniper, 22-year-old Tayer Kayed Ahmed, a member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade from the village of Silwad, using an old World War II M1 rifle, picked off nine Israeli soldiers at a West Bank checkpoint and managed to get away. Hamad would later be captured when he revealed the story to a friend who told another friend, and eventually the Israelis learned of it and sentenced him to multiple life sentences. Under international law, his action in resistance to an armed occupation was legitimate. Today, if Hamad's name is mentioned at all in the West Bank, it is whispered. While an occasional homemade rocket from Gaza fired by a Palestinian splinter group lands in Israel without causing casualties, usually in response to an Israeli assassination of a Palestinian activist, Hamas does its best to keep that from happening and giving Israel an excuse to make yet another war on the densely populated, largely defenseless Gaza Strip. You won't read or hear any of this in the mainstream media, and it's also hard to find in the alternative media, since at least the mainstream media believes it's important to maintain the fiction that there are two sides that must sit down and work out a solution. As if all this wasn't enough, Secretary of State John Kerry is expected to name Martin Indyk to represent the U.S. in whatever quote-unquote negotiations take place. Indyk is a familiar public figure, both as a U.S. government rep and a talking head for the mainstream media, including NPR, when the subject is Israel and the issue is Middle East peace. What the public is never told is Indyk's true background. The British-born Australian-raised Indyk began his Washington career in 1983 as a staff member for AIPAC, the registered pro-Israel lobby that uniquely, like all the other exceptions pertaining to Israel, is not obliged to register as a foreign agent. In 1985, he became the founding executive director of his think tank spawn, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, from whose ranks he was plucked by Bill Clinton in 1993 to serve as the first foreign-born U.S. ambassador to Israel. In order to place Indyk in that post, one now reserved exclusively for Jews, Clinton had indexed U.S. citizenship application rushed through Congress upon assuming the presidency, a maneuver without any historical precedent. In Innocent Abroad, a memoir of his experiences in Middle East diplomacy, published in 2009, Indyk wrote that he was, quote, first drawn to the Middle East through my Jewish identity and connection to Israel, end quote. Indyk was the founding director at the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution for the man he calls his godfather, media magnate Haim Saban. In a New York interview, Saban was quoted as saying that, quote, he is a one-issue man, and that issue is Israel, end quote. Indyk is currently the vice president and director for foreign policy at Brookings itself, which until succumbing to a $12.3 million gift from Saban in 2002 was the last independent think tank in Washington. Since then, it's become another Israeli-occupied territory. Indyk, by the way, was also the first U.S. ambassador to be stripped of a security clearance. He was under investigation in September 2010 for improperly handling sensitive material, reportedly using unclassified government-owned laptop computers to prepare memoranda and about discussions with foreign leaders. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright approved the suspension and restored it a month later. Not surprisingly, the prospect of Indyk's appointment as mediator was warmly received by both Netanyahu and his puppet Abbas. Finally, Indyk's old workplace, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which a couple of years ago changed its acronym from WINEP to TWI, achieved a major policy goal this week when it succeeded in getting the European Union to place the military wing of Hezbollah on its terrorist list, perhaps as compensation for initiating partial sanctions on Israel's West Bank settlements. It was a move the EU had been resisting despite major lobbying efforts not only by WINEP, but by the American Jewish Committee, the Israel Lobby's foreign policy arm, and both houses of Congress, which set aside their disagreements when Israel's demands are on the table. There was no real evidence that Hezbollah had committed any acts of terror in Europe was irrelevant. One suspected and accused of bombing a bus in Bulgaria that killed a number of Israeli tourists, the Bulgarian government finally acknowledged that evidence of Hezbollah involvement in the incident was inconclusive. Then there was a Lebanese man living in Cyprus who, after interrogation, admitted to keeping an eye on potential Israeli targets in that island nation for Hezbollah, but there was no evidence presented that either he or Hezbollah had committed or were planning any acts of violence on Cyprus's soil. It's likely that Hezbollah's decision to enter the Syrian civil war on the side of its longtime ally Syria was a critical factor in the EU's decision.